The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So how's your dog doing?
You know, she's great. It's almost a year since we've had a dog, and I'm surprised that
I'm actually a baby.
Yeah, exactly. She is treated like a baby. And I'm surprised I've turned into one of those dog people, you know, love going to the dog park and talking to people about their dogs. But, you know, she's had a few unexpected issues. She actually does shed a lot, even though I was told when we bought her she was a non-shedding breed, especially this spring. Wow, a lot of shedding.
On your furniture and stuff.
Yeah, and on the floors and things. And the other big problem is she likes to do her business on the grass versus the rocks we had specially put in place for her to use.
Come on.
So we haven't won that battle yet with her.
She's very stubborn. Like, you know, to a dog, the difference between rocks and grass is like an outhouse versus a nice restroom for us. So
yeah. Well, you should have told me that before we put all those rocks in, Peter.
So what are we talking about?
Well, I thought we should talk about the EV questions that we got. So this is our listener EV questions podcast.
Yeah, we got a lot of feedback, didn't we, on that last EV podcast that we did?
We did. We got tons of feedback and we wanted to address all your questions. And just like the dog, you know, maybe the electric vehicle has a few problems, but overall, I still really like it. So we'll talk about, honestly, some of those as well. But before we do that, I thought we would give an update on EV sales. Talk a little bit about oil demand and why we focus on EVs so much. What's the importance? So the data for 2020 is now in, and we saw fairly big increases in sales, especially in the second half of the year in Europe and China as a share of the total sales. So for example, on average, China was actually over 5% of all the light duty vehicles are now electric.
So let's say 100 people walk into a showroom, 95%.
Well, 5% get the electric car.
Yeah, 95 don't. Okay.
And by the way, that's battery electric and those plug-in hybrids.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but the vast majority are actually battery. But, you know, I count those plug-in hybrids as very similar because many of them go a fair amount of kilometers without the engine. So they're on battery for sometimes the first 30, 40 kilometers. And a lot of people, their actual daily commutes don't need the combustion engine. They can actually go on electric. So they are pretty consequential in terms of oil demand as well. Now, there are some estimates that things are really going to take off in China, and it could be near 20% of all light-duty vehicles in the next 5 years.
It's an interesting number, 20% by 2025, because there's a lot of environmental pundits that are suggesting we may see up to 50% by 2030. Do you think that's reasonable?
Well, you know, if we got to 20% by 2025 in China, now that's not the whole world. So for context, we're about 2 or 3% globally right now. So China is ahead. You know, Europe's another really strong market. About 7% of all sales last year were pure electric. Also expected strong growth to 2025 and may even be more than China. So they could get up to 20%. And that's a big auto market, Europe. And adoption there, especially in the last half of the year, really picked up. So that's important because those are two big car markets. And of course, US is behind in North America, but we're starting to see more sales here as well. Now, why does this matter? Because EVs, even at these volumes, can actually start to have some impact to oil demand by the 2025 time period. So we ran our oil demand model. And if we assume that EV sales got to 10 or 15% globally by 2025, which is possible on some of these projections, we would see about 1 million barrels a day of avoided oil demand, which doesn't seem like a big number. But in the context of the oil markets, as we've seen, 1 million barrel a day less demand actually can move the market from being tight to being slightly oversupplied, right? It does have consequences.
Well, you know, we should sort of caution the listener on this because when we put those models together, what we noticed was that there are some variables in that model that can really alter that number, the million barrels per day. One of them is the rate at which old vehicles are scrapped. And you know, I remember tweaking that number. And because older vehicles, combustion vehicles, are much more reliable these days because they're manufactured by robots and the parts are much more reliable, they stick around a lot longer. And the person who gets rid of an gasoline vehicle in Europe, typically it gets shipped off to a developing country and continues to burn combustion. So there's a lot of focus here on these sales numbers and what fraction they are of total vehicles, which represents the influx of new electric vehicles into the global fleet of a billion plus vehicles. But the rate at which vehicles leave the fleet is actually more consequential. And I know some of the countries in Europe are sort of considering paying for used vehicles and outright scrapping them, which if you really want to reduce oil demand, that's what you've got to do. But if you just put it in a sea can and send it to Africa or somewhere like that, then it really doesn't do much for mitigating global emissions.
Right. And if we find that people are still keeping the one combustion engine vehicle in their household even, sure, and using that for the longer trips, we could still put a fair amount, yeah, of kilometers on the combustion engine vehicles, although the vast majority of people's miles are put in more short trips in most households.
Yeah. And my household, full disclosure, so electric vehicle, had one for almost 5 years. And that's almost all for commuting. But our other vehicle is a combustion vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so this is a little bit like the microwave oven and full oven analogy. Just because you buy a microwave oven doesn't mean you get rid of your full oven. And that's another dynamic that you have to model in, is to what extent do people just do a partial substitution of their household mobility?
But it'd be interesting for you to calculate, you know, you could probably easily do that, how many kilometers you're putting on the combustion engine for the long commutes, yeah, versus the shorter ones, because I do think that the vast majority of your miles are probably the shorter.
It's substantially less. And I'm not trying to diminish the notion that these EV sales are not going to impact oil demand. They are. But just exactly how much is still yet to be seen.
Yeah, lots of variables. I will say that the IEA put out their 5-year oil market outlook, and the IEA matters. A lot of people say to me when I bring up oil demand by the IEA, oh, they've always been wrong. But the reality is the oil markets and watchers of the oil markets look very closely at the IEA and think about that in terms of the future. Mm-hmm. That just came out a couple of weeks ago. And they had an outlook where we have a fair amount of oil demand over the next few years as a consequence of catch up from COVID.
Yeah.
So there is quite a big bump, especially the end of 2021, 22, and even a little bit in 23. But by the time we get into 2024 and 2025, we see a real slowdown in demand. So there's still a little bit of growth, about 500,000 barrels a day each year growth. But that isn't very much compared to the past. For example, the last 5 years has been almost 3 times that in terms of annual demand growth.
Yeah.
And they say it's due to efficiency improvements,
yeah,
more EVs, and changing habits by consumers.
Yeah.
And all of that can really slow down demand. And that does have some consequences. A flat or only slightly growing demand profile is going to have the oil markets look different.
The oil markets, in many ways, and investors into oil equities, oil stocks, have already priced this flattening out of the demand by the end of the decade into pricing, the prices of the equities. I would argue almost even the prices of the commodities, if you look at the forward curve for oil. And it's not really pricing in any growth.
Yeah, and you're seeing that in terms of the valuation metrics associated, mm-hmm, with public companies. So, mm-hmm, yeah, I guess no surprise. But I would say that if we didn't have this expectation for EVs, I would expect that they'd have a slightly different outlook.
Yeah, well, totally. I mean, I think this is where the biggest impact of EV sales and EV, I'll call it momentum, is on the expectations that oil demand is going to roll over. It's not because, you know, a small fraction of the world's population is buying EVs and it's having a major dent in the oil demand. That's not the biggest impact. The impact is actually in the capital markets.
In the market psychology. And eventually going from this view of a growth market to a, mm-hmm, flat or slightly growing or, yeah, slightly declining,
yeah, yeah,
market. Okay, well, let's get into the questions that we got from all,
yeah,
our audience. So we really appreciate, mm-hmm, this. This is our first listener question podcast. So the first question was on battery life. So if you remember, mm-hmm, I talked about the economics of purchasing. And by the way, I'm going to talk about leasing later because that's even better. It was pointed out to me. But my math was, if I drove 20,000 kilometers a year, I would save 2,000 a year on fuel and another 1,000 a year on maintenance. And I made the comment that if we could get to 2030 with this car, I could save up to $5,000 per year because of the carbon tax making gasoline so expensive that, mm-hmm, the relative economics for owning my EV are even more compelling as we get out that far. So the question was, well, can I really expect my EV to last 10 years since the battery will hold less charge in 10 years? So just like your phone or your laptop, I've got a real issue with my laptop right now. It just doesn't hold charge at all anymore. Is this car that I bought not going to hold charge in 10 years and therefore not be very valuable? So it's a good question because we definitely have seen it happen to all of our electronics.
Some of these cars like Tesla guarantees the battery life, doesn't it?
Yeah. So my Model Y, had to go look this up. So bad for me not to look into this before I bought one. I get a guarantee that in 8 years' time or 160,000 kilometers, it will have 70% of its battery. So for instance, I bought it with about 500 kilometers of range. So if it doesn't hold 70% of that, I guess they would change out my battery. And by the way, the Model Y warranty is unique. Like every model might have a different warranty. So just when you look at electric cars and even Volkswagen, some of the other, they all have slightly different policies. So it's probably worth thinking about. At the end of the day, this is basically a battery on wheels. So you're paying for the battery and the value of the car has a lot to do with the battery. Now, there are perspectives that the batteries that I have in Model Y could probably go two times further than that before they would get to that 70% level. So it is uncertain. And it does matter how you use your battery.
How you charge it.
Yeah, like if I use those fast chargers all the time, I'm going to degrade it more than if I don't. And then another thing is when you get the car, by default, it wants you to only charge up to 80%, but you can charge up to 100 if you're going to go on a trip. But they don't recommend you do that all the time because that can degrade the battery. This, it's kind of like a balloon. If you blow it up to the biggest extent, it kind of puts too much pressure on the whole system.
So this is like, you got to change your whole psychology because, you know, in winter driving, you're always told to keep your gas tank topped up.
Yeah, here you're only going to go to 80%. Although if we're going to go on a trip, like when we went to Lake Louise, we did put it up to 100%. But you're not supposed to do that every day. That would degrade it over time. Anyway, in closing, this is a risk to EV ownership today. So thank you, listener, for pointing that out. It is uncertain. I would tell you, though, if my battery degraded to even half in 10 years and I can only go 250 kilometers of range, I still think there'd be value in my vehicle to sell because mostly when we're around town, we're not needing that much range. Like 250 is still enough range. So there'd be value in that car for an in-city vehicle, and I'm sure there would be a resale market for it. It wouldn't be as valuable as a car that has a greater range.
I can tell you that my use of the electric vehicle is 98% commuter around town.
Yeah, so 250-kilometer range, there'd be a market for that.
My battery's ranges for most of the time between 60 and 80% full. I pull it into the garage, plug it in. Now it's second nature, just like plugging in my phone. I don't even think about it.
I did want to note, too, that this is today's situation. The battery world continues to move. I wanted to point out a Canadian expert, Jeff Don, world-recognized lithium-ion battery researcher from Dalhousie University, is working with Tesla. And they are working for this 1 million mile or 1.6 million kilometer battery pack. So this would get rid of this problem. And he's actually published research that shows the battery chemistry that can get there.
Yeah.
And he says this battery would lose less than 10% of its capacity over that lifetime, the 1.6 million kilometer lifetime. So this could change fairly soon in terms of the issues.
I got to be honest. I mean, I think by mid-decade, 2025-ish, this is not going to be an issue, battery life.
Yeah. And then the other option is the solid states, which aren't going to have the same issues. And Toyota and others are going after that, Volkswagen. So this is an issue with today's for sure. But you're right. I think by 2025, there's enough work going on in this space that I don't think it will be as severe.
Okay.
I got a lot of questions on range issues in the cold weather. And I've actually had a lot more experience driving in the cold weather now than when we first did the podcast. And this is what I've come to. I think the thing you need to do if you want to be safe and not worry is to basically assume if it's more than minus 15C, assume your range is cut in half to be safe. So if my range is technically 500 kilometers.
Which is not really, honestly. That's sort of like
okay, well, let's say it's 480.
That's published. I mean, you know, if it says 500, I've learned you kind of multiply, and this is regular driving.
Yeah, without the cold
just
weather.
Without the cold weather. You multiply that by 0.7, 70%. So it's actually 350.
Okay,
That's what I find. Between going up and down hills and accelerating or having stuff in the trunk or whatever.
Yeah, well, and I suppose the way you drive, people. Peter.
Yeah, well, that's we won't talk about that. And if you go to winter driving, there's no question that 0.7 can drop to 0.55,
yeah.
I find.
I just cut it in half, and we've found that that works really well, and then you don't have an anxiety. So you make the plan that you need to charge. So for example, in the cold weather, we were driving to Canmore, charging up again, only 10 minutes, then getting out to Lake Louise and mm-hmm. then coming back. So that's how you deal with it. You do lose a lot of range. And the other interesting thing we found out is you lose a lot of range whenever you have something on top. So we don't put a box on the top of the car with the skis because that would reduce our range even more.
The drag is substantial.
And apparently bikes are a real problem. So if you have a bike rack on the back, it can significantly cut your range. Like I've seen reports of 30 to 40% or more. We're going to test that out this summer and get back to you. But you really can't take this vehicle on long car trips with the bikes on the back.
Or long car trips without charging stations.
Yeah, you'd need frequent charging stations because you now cut your range so significantly by having that drag. So,
but
you know,
still, I mean, I guess I'll take the other side for a moment that if there's a dense charging network along the Trans-Canada, then it's not really an issue if you have to stop once every 250K instead of once every 400K or something, or 300K, right?
That's like, exactly it.
But the issues arise, especially in a country like ours, if you're going to more remote areas where the charging station density is very sparse.
Well, the issue already exists today because we only have charging really on Highway 1, the Trans-Canada, and it's really spread out. Like you got to get from Canmore all the way to Golden. That's how long the leg is. So if you have a bike on the back with my car, you're not going to be able to make it. That's why I was saying we in the last podcast, we actually would be better to have right now in Golden, there's numerous charging stations by different companies. Hmm. We would have been better to have spread that out over the whole distance of the road equally right. than having three charging stations in Golden.
More charging facilities along the way with convenience stores, so you'll be eating more snacks.
That's right, while you're charging up. But remember those, you don't take too long to charge if you do it frequently. So maybe you'd spend 15 to 20 minutes at each charging station, you know, in that scenario. Okay, let's talk about the economics, because this is a point I did not understand, that the economics of a lease actually make the EV the cheapest option. So I was saying how to purchase, I felt like I paid a bit more than the equivalent vehicle, but I felt like I could make up for it in a few years with my savings on fuel. But the lease is actually a really interesting calculation. So the lease payment for a Model Y is about $750 a month Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you put $5,000 down, and that's 48 months. And then you consider that your fuel savings is about $150 a month.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's $750, but you save like $150 in fuel costs, where the equivalent ICE vehicle costs you $650 a month. So your out-of-pocket expenses are actually significantly lower with the Tesla. So this got me thinking because the recent KPMG survey, it was done in February of 2021, found that they did a survey of Canadians that nearly 70% of Canadians who plan to buy a new car in the next 5 years want their next vehicle purchase to be an EV, either a hybrid or a pure. So if that's actually where people are at, and then they see this math, you know, maybe the sales will surprise people.
Well, yeah, I guess I have a bit more skeptic molecules in my DNA than others about these sorts of surveys. It's one thing to ask somebody, hey, do you think you're going to buy an electric vehicle for the next time around? And 70% of the people say yes. I mean, I don't know how the question was worded. But, you know, when you actually weigh the potential inconveniences versus conveniences and so on, I'm not convinced that number is accurate when it actually goes to the purchase. Like, we'll see. I mean, there's even issues like if, like me, you want to be able to plug in the garage, you have to call an electrician to run a high amperage cable from your utility box into the garage. If your basement's developed, then it's going to cost you a lot more because you've got to fish the wire, or in the worst case, rip some wallboard down to fish the wire through. And, you know, that's costly. Some instances, it could cost you up to a couple grand just to wire the thing up. So, you know, you kind of net all these things out at the 11th hour when you're about to make your purchasing decision. And I think that, you know, the social issues of convenience, I still think are big. Now, we are overcoming those substantially because of the superior utility of the electric vehicle in many dimensions. But it has to be superior in every dimension, I think, before people are really going to, in high percentages, buy it. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
I totally agree with you. There's all those barriers. And also the utility isn't the same. But the fact that you could get it out of pocket cheaper, I think, is a surprise.
I think it's huge. And it's a smoother ride. The acceleration's awesome. The comfort is awesome. The commuting value is a no-brainer for around town. But if you want to preserve all option value, like if say, oh, I want to go to some small town and go fishing in the middle of BC, then all of a sudden there's different issues.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, the next one we had was just a comment. In fact, these were questions and comments that the economics for fuel savings are not as good if you're using third-party chargers, which is totally right. It varies quite a bit, but in general, you know, in Alberta, we have very cheap power here. I'm paying about 6 cents per kilowatt hour at home. And at these third-party chargers, it's more like 25 cents a kilowatt hour.
And a lot of places, even in the home, it's 20 plus cents per kilowatt hour.
We have very cheap power
here. You cascade everything. And if in future a road tax is put on the electricity or on the EV, because right now road taxes are all on the gallon of gasoline or liter of gasoline. If electric vehicles in substantial numbers start hitting the road, then there's a question of road tax as well. So, you know, the differential in the operating cost is highly regionally variable and also variable depending upon where you buy your electricity.
Yeah. I would say, though, that $2,000 a year of fuel savings, it goes down to $1,500 if I had to pay 25 cents. So there's still some fuel savings there, but it does kind of hurt.
Well, here in Alberta right now, it's a bonanza in terms of the savings.
Yeah, because our power prices are really cheap. I did want, as a side note, I'm new to the electrical markets here and understanding electricity, but I wanted to give people some interesting factoids about charging. When you're charging at one of those superchargers, we've had as high as 183 kilowatts flowing into the battery at one time. So to put that in perspective, that's like the consumption of 183 homes on average. And if you think about it, they have 6 to 8 chargers. So if all the cars showed up and started charging, you'd have like the equivalent of 1,400 houses electricity going through one of those little charging areas. It's kind of phenomenal. These are the fast chargers. Just for comparison, when I'm at my home, it's the equivalent of 7 kilowatts. So that's about the equivalent of 7 average homes going into the battery when we're just at home. Yeah. So just to give people a magnitude, but that's
those charging
crazy.
Stations are very high amperage and put out a lot of juice.
Yeah. So I think the utilities are going to have to obviously do some infrastructure build out if we're going to start to get more of those charging stations.
It's a common question is, can the grid handle it? And, you know, in modern economies in built out areas, the answer is yes, largely, but there's many regions, or even our own country and the world for sure, where just the grid just can't handle that kind of current flow.
Yeah, and this is related to another question that we got about what about people who do not have the luxury of a garage with adequate electrical capacity, to your point, Peter? Mm. How do they charge a vehicle on the street if it's the only place you have to park? Or what happens if you live in a condo where you don't really have control of the ability to upgrade your electrical plug-in? I think it's a good question. And the answer really is you turn to China. China has the world's highest EV adoption rate. And most people live in apartments and have that same situation. So what's happening there, and we got some data, is we're seeing many more people go to these third-party chargers, the fast chargers. So for instance, you live in an apartment and just like you go to the gas station a couple times a week, you go to this supercharger, you sit there for 20 minutes and you charge up again. And you're seeing way higher use of third-party charging infrastructure in China. And I think that's what's going to happen as we get more adoption in Europe and North America.
Yeah, I think this is a key point. So you don't have a gas pump in your garage. Why would you expect to have a charger? Would be a common counter argument. Well, I can go to the gas station and assuming there's nobody lined up, I can fill up in a matter of 5 minutes. Whereas if I have to wait around for 20 minutes to get the thing charged, that's a whole different circumstance on my psychology.
Yeah, but you have high-speed internet and you're not standing out there holding the pump for while you're filling, which is very uncomfortable in the winter. Yeah. You're inside, you're warm, you get high-speed internet.
Yeah, it's just
time goes pretty fast.
Yeah, but I think the notion these days with short attention spans and just sort of the go-go-go type of mentality is people are loath to sort of sit around and want to wait for something to happen.
Yeah.
Like, I think this is a major psychological barrier, but I do think it's going to be overcome with progressively faster charging batteries over the course of the next decade.
Well, and we're seeing it in China. So there is quite a big adoption. I'm looking at this chart, maybe in the range of a third of the charging is going on in these third parties.
Yeah.
So I think that's how that's going to happen in terms of that. And I also think for the utilities, it's a way better situation. Wouldn't you rather just upgrade these charging infrastructures than have every condo building start to need a draw that's 7 or 8 times higher than what it has today. The cost of building out that infrastructure at the building level is going to be way more expensive than putting in these focused charging stations.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think, though, that people who model these sorts of things underestimate the value that individuals place on convenience, and that increasingly people will pay more and more for convenience, or the converse, they don't tolerate inconvenience as much as they used to. So this is a big deal. I think it's a big deal.
Okay. Well, we'll have to revisit this in 2025 or 2030, because I think it's inconvenient what we do today, especially because you have to stand outside holding that pump and breathing in all the gasoline fumes.
Sure.
It's not pleasant.
I'm not arguing that, but time is at such a premium for people. It's not the dimension of standing outside getting cold and breathing fumes. It's people are placing a much higher value on their time today than they used to. Mm-hmm. And so an extra 10 minutes of sitting around or standing around or browsing the potato chips in the convenience store, I just think is a convenience hurdle that a lot of people are going to think about before making their buying decision.
Okay. What happens if you had your laptop and you could do a half hour work? Okay, we're going to move on. We're not going to solve this one. Another question, I'll do it quickly, is we had questions around the greenhouse gas emissions benefits of an EV. And the question was specifically, it takes a lot of energy to make the battery. We spent time on a previous podcast talking about the benefits of using electricity over gasoline just on the fuel. Mm-hmm. But if you consider the energy needed to make the battery, then maybe it doesn't look as good. And we will put a link to a study that the IEA did looking at this question. They assessed the emissions over a 10-year lifetime of a mid-sized car, and they assumed various different batteries. But one of the batteries, we looked at the 80 kilowatt hour battery, which is the typical battery size in a North American car today. And basically, the overall takeaway was when the cars roll off the lot, EVs have higher emissions. If they are made in China, which uses more coal in their electricity system, the car could be 2.2 times more emissions intense for an EV than an ICE, and 1.7 times more if it was made in Europe, where they have cleaner electricity. But then when you start driving, the benefits of the EV overcome that, even if you have electricity that represents the average electricity in the world, which has some coal and natural gas in it, and you in the end are quite a bit ahead to have an EV. And then if you had zero emissions electricity, then the EV over 10 years would have only about 40% of the emissions of an ICE. Mm-hmm. So in short, and we can put a link to this, the takeaway is, yes, they do take way more energy to produce,
upfront. But
then the fuel savings over the course of the life of the car make up for that.
It's a great conversation, and thank you to our audience for these great questions. There's more. Keep them coming, and we'll keep you apprised of how we're doing. I mean, despite all my reticence about where these things are going, there's no question that EVs are going to gain more and more prominence as more and more models come out. That's the other thing we haven't discussed is, there's many more models of EVs coming out. So choice of utility and type of vehicle that you're going to be able to buy is going to dramatically increase here in the next couple of years.
Yeah, by 2025, there's just kind of an order of magnitude more options compared to today. Mm-hmm. So we will keep tracking this and looking at how the sales are going.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.